Chapter 3. First Impressions. When you walk into a room, what impression do you make? Do you make people look at you and think, "There's someone confident," or do they think, "Poor, pathetic creature," or, worst of all, do they not notice you at all? In 1979, an American psychologist, Robert Zajonc, published a theory of hot cognitions. He claimed that we make almost instant judgments when we encounter new people. Within 3 seconds of meeting someone new, we decide whether we like them or not. Our response is not so much a rational assessment as something emotional. Sometimes we call it chemistry, but what triggers this chemistry is less clear. Brain research shows how quickly this chemical reaction happens. It takes about 400 milliseconds to trigger a response, either positive or negative. Initially, Zajonc argued that there was nothing we could do to affect someone's hot cognitions of us, but that has changed as we have discovered more and more about what creates good and bad first impressions. Exercise 3.1. Self-observation. You are going out on a date. What do you do? Does anxiety make you pause, check, and recheck yourself? Do you resent all the trouble you are taking? Or do you think you look okay as it is, and if he or she likes you, it won't make any difference? In the past, only women spent much time making up and grooming themselves, but in the past 15 years, men have also started to prettify themselves, so there is now a large industry devoted to male beauty products. We are endlessly neurotic about our appearance, but luckily, there are always experts willing to help. Image makers. Michelle T. Sterling founded Global Image Group, which helps clients develop a strong first impression and brand identity through wardrobe and image development, communication, etiquette, and protocol skills. She argues that each and every one of us is a brand and adds, "People appraise your visual and behavioral appearance from head to toe. They observe your demeanor, mannerisms, and body language, and even assess your grooming and accessories, watch, handbag, and briefcase. With only 3 seconds, you make an indelible impression. You may intrigue some and disenchant others. Once the first impression is made, it is virtually irreversible." But there is hope, Sterling claims. You can learn to make a positive and lasting first impression, modify it to suit any situation, and come out a winner. Doing so requires you to assess and identify your personality, physical appearance, lifestyle, and goals. I don't promise this book will turn you into a global brand, but it should at least make you aware of some of the ways you can go wrong, and help you start to fix your flaws. Mr. Tall conquers all. Consider these two descriptions. She walked into the room, her shoulders held high, and smiled. He shambled into the room and slumped down on a chair in the far corner. We form images of these two people quickly, partly because we associate posture with personality and self-confidence. The first element of good body language has been known for centuries. In ancient Rome, soldiers were taught to stand up and to stand tall. If you slouched on your spear, the centurion yelled at you, as the drill sergeant will today, 2,000 years later. The idea that standing tall conveys self-confidence, poise, and good character is deeply ingrained in all human beings. It comes from our animal heritage. The animal who stands tallest in the pack is often the leader of that pack. Men are very aware of their own height and may fret about it because they believe women prefer men who are above average height. In November 2006, a quick trawl of the lonely hearts in the Sunday Telegraph showed that the first word men used to describe themselves was not sexy or intelligent or charming, but tall. The same was true in the Times of the 17th of November 2006. 12 of the 39 men who were looking for women said they were tall, tall, and good-looking, tall, and interesting, or tall and solvent. Tall is all. Until recently, short men were stuck. Few things look as silly as men who wear shoes with high heels, but now new shoe technology offers hope. On the internet, you can buy height increase insoles or individually made status shoes. No one can spot that they're giving you a lift. These force you to walk on tiptoe, but can increase your height by between 8 and 10 centimeters. But if you don't want to mess around with fancy shoes, at least you can make sure you stand tall and straight. When a confident person enters the room, he or she looks around to size up the situation. Socially skilled individuals pause briefly and head in a definite direction. They are then adept at inserting themselves into a group without appearing to be barging in. Decide which group you are going to make for. Once you have made that decision, don't waver. Spot a gap between people where you can fit yourself in. If there is no obvious gap, hover on the edge of the group. Place your feet so that they are gently nudging in. You can then gradually introduce yourself into the circle. This can be done in two ways. 1. Without saying a word, by leaning in with one shoulder and moving your feet. 2. By saying something to announce your presence, then the group has to be quite rude to reject you. It is much harder to insert yourself into a group if your posture lacks confidence, because you will not nudge your shoulders and feet so easily into the circle. Tip: if you feel unsure about how to do this, you can practice it with one or two friends. The art of inserting your shoulders is a subtle one. The most solid finding is simple and not surprising. Someone who stands looks more dominant than someone who is sitting. Height really matters, but so does the way you sit. A man who is sitting hunched into himself and does not look out or at anyone. This posture suggests depression and lack of confidence. Sometimes, however, posture can scream that someone is an overconfident layabout. The man who has put his feet up on his desk almost certainly has an inflated ego and is very possessive of his territory. That pose says, "I own it all, and I don't care how rude it looks." Don't do it. And be on your guard against anyone who does, and of the slightly less offensive soul who drapes his leg over a chair when talking to you. To test how good your posture is, you have to be prepared to be self-critical in the mirror. Exercise 3.2. Self-observation. The look-in-the-mirror test. Strip down to your underwear. Stand in front of a large mirror. Breathe deeply. Close your eyes. Count to 10. Open your eyes. Focus on yourself in the mirror. The first thing you have to work out is, are you standing straight? Turn and look at yourself in profile. This is the best position in which to judge how straight you are standing. Watch for the angle of your head. Is it held high, or is it inclined? Sloping down to your shoulders. If it's sloping down, stretch it back till it is straight. An acid test of how straight you stand sounds like something out of ballet school. Place a book on your head. Does it fall off at once, or can you, first, just keep it balanced on your head, standing still? If you can do that, try walking 2 steps, then 5 steps, without the book falling off. If you can manage 5 steps without the book falling off, you are really standing straight. Tip: if you are in a relationship, you can observe each other and time which of you can keep a book on their head longer. But don't try this with anything heavy. A friend of mine tried carrying a container of water on her head after seeing a film on women in Africa where they do this all the time. She put her back out and needed physiotherapy for 9 months. Stick to books. Posture helps create Zajonc's Hot Cognitions, 1979. Someone who slouches is seen as less confident, and depressed people tend to slouch more. Standing tall won't just make you look good, it will also make you feel good. The science fiction writer Brian Aldiss, writing in The Times to celebrate his 80th birthday in 2005, said he liked to walk tall when he went to his local shops. It always improved his mood. Sometimes men and women add to their height by the way they style their hair. The big hair look. In mammals generally, clean hair is a sign of high status, good health, and careful grooming. As birds preen their feathers and lions puff their mane, so humans use hair as a part of their display. People have been doing so for thousands of years. Upper-class women in the Egyptian Middle Kingdom liked huge wigs and bound their tresses with ribbons of silver or linen, which they then topped with jewellery. The French queen, Marie Antoinette, pioneered the bouffant hairdo. Punk hair is less bouffant, but even more colourful and, in its way, big. Psychologists have found that women mark lifestyle and career changes with different hairstyles. According to Grant McCracken, in his 1997 book, Big Hair, A Journey into the Transformation of Self, your hair also signals some aspects of your personality, according to a Procter & Gamble study by Marie LaFrance of Yale in 2000. She found that, in the USA at least, hairstyle plays a significant role in first impressions. For a woman, short, tousled hair conveys confidence and an outgoing personality, but does not suggest she is sexy. A medium-length, casual haircut suggests intelligence and good nature, while long, straight, blonde hair projects sexuality and affluence, and letting your roots show is seen as a sign of depression. Tip: if you feel low, get your hair done, and your nails. The next hurdle in the first impression stakes is how you greet someone. Greetings, handshakes, and social kissing. Watch people arriving at any function. After the hosts and the various guests have embraced, they back off, and one or both always looks away. Anthropologist Adam Kendon, 1994, calls this the cutoff, and thinks it may be an equilibrium-maintaining device, as does F. Davis. Every relationship, except a very new one, has its own customary level of intimacy, and if a greeting is more intimate than the relationship warrants, some kind of a cut-off is needed afterwards so that everything can get quickly back to normal. One theory claims that the first people to shake hands were the tribes of the Yemen at the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. As Islam spread, the practice grew. In the New Testament, however, St. Paul mentions in Galatians that when he visited Jerusalem and met with James, Cephas, and John, they each gave him the right hand of friendship. If the Bible is right about body language, that would suggest Greek and Roman citizens were shaking hands in order to bond long before Islam started. Another theory claims men shook hands because they could not shake if they were carrying a sword, dagger, or gun. In the Middle Ages, when knights were always rapiering each other, offering your open hand showed you came in peace and were not concealing a weapon. But whenever the handshake started, it appears to have gone out of fashion by 1660. In 1662, the diarist Samuel Pepys wrote as if handshaking were a newfangled custom. His entry for Saturday, 15th of February, 1662, runs, "With the two Sir Williams to the Trinity House, and therein their society had the business debated of Sir Nicholas Crisp's house at Deptford. Then to dinner, and after dinner, I was sworn a younger brother, Sir W. Ryder being deputy master for my Lord of Sandwich, and after I was sworn, all the elder brothers shake me by the hand. It is their custom, it seems." If it was their custom, it seems, shaking hands could hardly have been that common. The Quakers also introduced the handshake among themselves around 1660. They felt it was more egalitarian and less flowery than the usual bowings, scrapings, and salams. The second American president, Thomas Jefferson, who entered the White House in 1797, encouraged shaking of hands for similar reasons. The good shake. Today, the handshake is a universal gesture from Tokyo to Tottenham. The Japanese used to bow to introduce themselves, but as they have become increasingly westernized, they shake hands more. But shaking hands is not as simple as it seems, because the wrong shake suggests a flawed personality. Cordillo, 2002, a psychologist who has made the handshake her life study, argues that if you proffer a limp handshake, you are likely to be seen as insecure and untrustworthy. Those who give a full, firm handshake will be judged to be more outgoing, more open to new experiences, more conscientious, and more agreeable. Women who shake firmly get rated as more intelligent. Cordillo stresses, for example, that nurses must know how to shake hands well, both to reassure patients and to establish their own professional status. A good shake also requires steady eye contact. You should look at the person you are shaking with, straight in the eyes, though without staring too hard at them. Exercise 3.3, Self-Observation. Write down what you find off-putting when someone shakes hands with you. When shaking hands, the position of the palms reveals a great deal about the different status of the shakers. When the top palm clamps down on the other, this is the position of power. The infamous Nazi salute was palm down and signaled their obsession with power and control. A complete opposite is Roderick Spode, a ludicrous would-be dictator invented by the English comic writer P.G. Wodehouse. Spode fails totally as a leader, and what is his movement's salute? The Spode salute has the palm pointed up, not down. No one who wants to be seen as a strong man should place his palms in a position where someone else can slap him down. The high-fives greeting is interesting, as both parties keep their palms vertical, so no one dominates. There are other traps to avoid. Cordillo, 2002, warns against a two-handed shake. Using the other hand to cover the clasped hand may be meant as friendly, but this can be misconstrued as motherly, controlling, or too intimate. One exception to this rule, however, is when there is a big gap in status between those shaking hands. Bill Clinton is famous for clasping both hands over those he shakes with, and that is always seen as a sign that he cares for ordinary people. People felt flattered if the President of the United States lingered in physical contact with them, but if someone normal puts his free hand on the other person's shoulders or grips their forearms, he is invading the other person's personal space, which may be resented. In an amusing aside, Cordillo advises people who suffer from sweaty palms to keep a handkerchief handy and dry their hands just before shaking. The question of how long to keep shaking is also the subject of research. Let go too soon, and that suggests you think the other person's hand is dirty and that you don't want to be shaking it anyway. Cling on for too long, and you seem to be invading the other person's space. The perfect length of time to hold onto the other person's hand is 2.7 seconds, according to Cordillo. Greetings and personality. Your movements should give an impression of your personality. People who make strong, definite movements are seen as more dominant. We also see people as more dominant if they gesticulate more, make more eye contact, and show more animation on their face. To look more dominant, 1. Make definite moves. 2. Make these moves forceful. 3. Keep eye contact. 4. Animation on the face. To look weak, 1. Wear more clothes. 2. Make smaller gestures. 3. More hand and ankle gestures. 4. Lack of expression. Submissive women also tend to stay in the same posture for longer, while women who move more are seen as dominant. Exercise 3.4, Self-Observation. Time your handshake. If you discover it's too brief, it may reflect your anxiety. Practice till you automatically do it for about 2.7 seconds. Next, if you want to seem stronger, practice making more dramatic gestures and, especially, swinging the lower part of your leg, though the police have often claimed that the tension of being under suspicion leads guilty people to fidget and swing the lower part of their leg. But personality is not just a question of how strong or weak your handshake may seem. The British psychologist Hans Isenk, 1973, argued that people could be placed on a continuum of extroversion and introversion. He developed the Isenk personality inventory, which includes questions like, do you enjoy going to parties? Do you sometimes feel depressed for no apparent reason? Are you usually the person who first touches someone else? The Isenk personality inventory has proved itself reliable over 40 years. Many of us can be labeled as either extroverts or introverts, and there are significant differences between the two. Introverts are shyer and more anxious. They do not go about slapping people on the back because they are more inhibited about physical contact. If you are introverted, you probably 1. Won't be the first person to offer your hand. 2. Will allow someone to place her palm on top of yours. 3. Will want to remove your hand first because the contact feels too invasive. 4. Will worry whether your handshake is firm enough. Extroverts, on the other hand, will not have such self-doubts, but may behave in other off-putting ways. For example, they may pump your hand up and down and not let go for well over Cordillo's perfect 2.7 seconds. Exercise 3.5. Self-observation. To know whether you are introverted or extroverted, listen to the following 16 questions. Note the answer that is most like you. Question 1. Are you happiest when you get involved in some project that calls for immediate action? Yes, maybe, or no. When you climb up any stairs, do you normally take them two at a time? Yes, no, maybe. Do you eat so fast you usually finish your meal before everyone else? Yes, no, or maybe. Does slow traffic drive you crazy when you are driving? Yes, no, or maybe. Do you like setting up leisure activities? Yes, maybe, or no. You are presented with a new project. Are you likely to feel you really hate having to handle something new? Yes, maybe, or no. When you are walking with other people, do they often have difficulty keeping up with you? No, yes, or maybe. Do you often rush helter-skelter from one activity to another without stopping to relax? Yes, maybe, no. Do you often feel you can't be bothered to do things? Maybe, no, or yes. When you have to meet new people, do you dread the awful introduction rituals? No, yes, or maybe. Is a dreadful holiday one where every day you have to go out to admire some new sight no tourist could miss? No, yes, or maybe. Do you find that you are often anxious for no reason? No, yes, or maybe. Do you usually wake up in the morning bright and raring to go? Yes, maybe, or no. Do other people seem to be more outgoing than you are? Yes, maybe, or no. If they seem more outgoing, does this make you feel worried? No, yes, or maybe. Do you get agitated if you have to wait for someone? Yes, sometimes, or no. Answers. Extroverts will answer yes to questions 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, and 13. Introverts will answer yes to questions 6, 9, 10, 11, 12, 14, 15, and 16. So score 2E for each yes to the extrovert questions, and 1E for each maybe. Score 2N for each yes to the introvert question, and 1E for each maybe. The highest extrovert score will be 16. The highest introvert score is also 16. If you score above 10, you are highly extroverted or introverted. In the range 6 to 10, you are middling. In the range 0 to 4, your scores are low. It is unlikely, but not impossible, for someone to score high on both extroversion and introversion. Such people will glad-hand others and behave in a very confident and expansive way, but they will also feel anxious about that very behavior. It may feel like an act to them, and their body language may well veer from one extreme to another. So if you are like that, learning to relax and slow down might be sensible. Social kissing. In elegant society, men used to kiss the fingers of women rather than shake their hands. But now in the UK, when men and women and women meet, they often kiss, especially if they are middle class. These aren't passionate kisses, but air kisses, and skin rarely meets skin. Sometimes there may be a light brush of the lips on the cheek. The sexes started to kiss socially as far back as the 1920s, the era of jazz and big dance bands. Conservatives feared it would lead to unbridled orgies, so everyone had to buckle up and restrain themselves. The best way was to kiss, but not really kiss, which is a good definition of social kissing. Putting your lips briefly to someone's cheek is intimate, but, in theory at least, not sexual. In the Boston Globe, in September 2006, writer Daniel Axt warned, however, that kissing hello and goodbye is surely more dangerous than a handshake, and the whole cheek-to-cheek pecking business can become dreadfully embarrassing. Axt added, "At dinner parties, I come away from this uneasy minuet feeling that I've somehow mishandled things or been slighted. A social triple lust for men and women alike, the whole complex negotiation is a perfect metaphor for the exquisite dance of self-mastery all of us must perform in our relentless co-ed, multi-ethnic and hypersensitive society. It's a test, in other words." I suspect that Axt hates social kissing, partly because he is quite introverted. The test for the social kisser is to show you can get close without getting intimate. After all, you social kiss in public, not in the privacy of your bedroom. It reflects the need to seem natural and unconstrained at all times, Axt noted. Even though, of course, one's lack of constraint is itself entirely constrained, which is why we have social kissing rather than social fondling. Axt argued that social kissing is a social safety valve. He added, perhaps a little dramatically, that it is a regulated infidelity, kind of like bundling among the Puritans, except designed to inoculate against courtship rather than promote it. Bundling was a practice whereby young, unmarried Puritans shared a bed but were not supposed to touch. They were put in an intimate situation, but no intimacy was supposed to take place because the Bible forbade it. Axt noted, "Humans weren't made to spend this much time in the company of members of the opposite sex who aren't our spouses, who get dolled up before coming to the office, and who, inevitably, develop some level of intimacy with us. People need some socially sanctioned system of building immunity toward one another. And social kissing provides such a system, because it has strict rules. When we meet people of the opposite sex in our free and easy, if stressed, society, we often have the maximum of temptation and the maximum of opportunity. So we need boundaries. And the rules of social kissing provide those. When you kiss romantically, you look into someone's eyes. When you greet someone with a social kiss, you usually end up looking at his or her ear. Tips. It is wise, therefore, to follow these rules. 1. Do not social kiss on the lips. 2. The kiss should be quick. A kiss on the cheek of more than 1.5 seconds suggests that one of you, at least, has a more intimate agenda in mind. 3. Do not lean your body into the other person's body, which is what you would do in a normal kiss. 4. Do not put your arms around the other person you are social kissing. That is too forceful. 5. Do not kiss them on the nose, as this is too playful and intimate. 6. If you are air kissing, be sure not to nibble the ear. You may now practice social kissing with whomever you like. Gang body language. Studies of body language also stress the differences between different cultures, as we shall see in Chapter 11. The principle also applies to particular subcultures. Standing ramrod straight is not the way to show you are confident in certain social groups. The gangs of Peckham, and indeed Moscow, aren't known for their military posture, but they have their own body language and swaggers for conveying confidence. In the next chapter, I look at personal space and how we can use body language to define and defend it. Chapter 4. Personal Space and the Personal Touch. You know the feeling when you were at a party. Jim has had a little too much to drink and is telling you how the world really is. To make sure you don't miss a syllable of his wisdom, he leans right into your face. You can see every mark on his skin. When a man is right in your face or too much in your face, this is usually an aggressive gesture. Personal space is the invisible area around each of us, the space we feel we need to keep others out of in order to be comfortable, the very center of our territory. But if someone comes into our personal space, it does not always have to be uncomfortable. One of the great clichés of cinema is the close-up before the first kiss. In the film The American President, Michael Douglas plays a widowed president who invites a political lobbyist, played by Annette Bening, to dinner. As they inspect the china in the White House, he comes closer to her. She comes closer to him. They edge on each other's personal space. Their moves are tentative, but their hormones are in overdrive. Then their faces and lips move closer to each other. Then the personal space between them dissolves as they kiss. At this romantic moment, an aide interrupts. The president is needed in the Situation Room to decide whether or not to bomb Libya. Eventually, though, the romance gets back on track. A frame-by-frame analysis of the seconds leading up to the kiss clearly shows the way we can let someone into the personal space we usually protect. The extent of personal space. Psychologists have tried to measure the personal space, or bubble, we create around ourselves. The best estimate, and it is an estimate, is that for an average Westerner, personal physical space is about 60 centimeters on either side, 70 centimeters in front, and 40 centimeters behind. Culture and personality both affect what people see as comfortable personal space, culture more so. Some researchers claim that there are four categories of personal space. 1. The intimate distance for embracing or whispering, 15 to 45 centimeters. 2. The personal distance for conversations among good friends, 45 to 120 centimeters. 3. The social distance for conversations among acquaintances, 120 to 360 centimeters. 4. The public distance used for public speaking, 360 centimeters or more. Exercise 4.1, self-observation. Try to work out your comfortable personal space. To do this, you need to stand close to a good friend, someone you are having a relationship with, a work colleague, if you are a parent, one of your children. Note the differences in how close you are with each of these different groups, and especially when you feel too close for comfort. This can be turned into a good party game. The boundaries of personal space depend not just on culture, but also on circumstances. I often travel on the London Tube in the rush hour when everyone is crammed up against perfect strangers. Normally, you would only be this close to someone in an intimate situation. Forced so close to people like this, we use many conscious and unconscious signals to remind ourselves and our fellow travelers that this is not true closeness. There is no reason to suppose the Paris, Athens, Moscow, New York, or Tokyo tubes are any different. Keep out, even though you are so close, signals. 1. One way people cope with so much proximity is to turn the trunk away so that while they stay physically close, that closeness is less direct. 2. Avoiding eye contact is another keep-out signal. The glassy stare at no one makes it very clear that you are not inviting real involvement. The eyes almost defocus in this situation. 3. Avoiding speech is another such signal. Not speaking to anyone, even though they have a perfect view of the other person's eyes, hair, and sometimes dandruff. 4. A fourth signal is the way passengers avoid any touch, even if other people are only an inch away. This sometimes requires a few contortions. If people do accidentally touch, they tend to apologize with a quick, terse, sorry. The tension such closeness causes becomes obvious if the train jolts to a halt and people bump into each other. Passengers burst into nervous laughter. They have been in a situation which seems to be quite intimate, but have just avoided touching each other. Now the train has banged them together, and the nervous laughter is both a release and a signal that makes it clear that touching other travelers is a mistake. Children often burst out laughing when they make mistakes, but because their body language is less assured, they often add something like, "Oops, I shouldn't have done that." Some psychologists argue that passengers on the underground do not see each other as individuals, but as inanimate objects, and that this is the only way we avoid fights and mad, passionate clinches between London Bridge and Piccadilly. I find this a bit extreme. People know perfectly well that their fellow sardines on the tube are human beings just like them, and understand it's only the fact they are all travelling on the crowded train that pushes them so physically close. But again, there are issues of personality. Extroverts will tend to have fewer inhibitions about invading personal space. Introverts will be more awkward about allowing people into their personal space and need more of it. Men who are seen as cold seem to be given more space too. A well-established personality test, the Myers-Briggs type indicator, even claims there is a kind of personality, the I never get perfection type, who may have a more extreme need for personal space than others. People with this personality type feel deeply and hate conflict, which is why they hate having their personal space invaded. Personal space and territory. Changing the distance between two people can also signal an increase or a decrease in dominance. I get close to you to emphasize a point I want to make, and often it can be one you don't want to hear. Police interrogators are taught that this violation of personal space can put pressure on suspects and witnesses. Detectives crowd the person they are interrogating. Such invasion of personal space gives the interrogator a psychological advantage. In a film I made for Channel 4, The False Confessions File, 1990, a number of suspects described how pressured they felt when the officers came very close to them. The idea of personal space is linked to that of territory. Humans do not mark their territories as animals do, by urinating, but the principle is much the same. People vary in how territorial they are, but to be highly territorial is very human. It is a trait we have inherited from other animals, and you can see that at lectures, on planes, and in your own home. Students who attend the second in a series of lectures usually sit in precisely the same seats they occupied at the first lecture. People do their best in trains and planes to make sure the seat next to them stays empty. They often pile it out with coats and luggage. A teenager may well see his or her room as private territory and ban mum and dad from coming in. Often men make their study or the garden shed their sacred space. There are no serious studies of whether men are more territorial than women, but I have been in relationships where if I trespassed into a woman's dressing space or the table where she kept her makeup, there would be hell to pay. The quiz in Exercise 4.2 may not reveal the most flattering aspects of your personality, but try to be honest. Exercise 4.2. Self-observation. How territorial are you? Which of the following statements is true for you? Again, we will use a 5-point scale. 5, always true. 4, quite often true. 3, sometimes true. 2, very occasionally true. And 1, absolutely untrue. 1. I like my house to be neat and tidy. 2. If I can't find something, I always suspect my other half or the kids have fiddled with it and lost it. 3. When someone sits in my mum's favourite armchair, I get very tense because no one should be using something that was hers. 4. I would always share a toothbrush with my lover. 5. I hate it when the neighbors prune the trees which hang over into our garden. 6. One of the best things about my new job is that I have a parking space of my own. 7. I do not think people are watching me. That would be really paranoid. 8. On the beach, I like to choose the sun lounger at the end of the section, as this gives me more privacy. 9. When someone steps behind my desk at work, it doesn't bother me much. 10. I always like to sleep on the same side of the bed. 11. My girlfriend and I take it in turns to drink when we go out. I don't mind her driving me. 12. When I go shopping with my other half, I find it very irritating that he or she thinks that he or she should push the trolley. 13. I have special places where I live where no one else should go. 14. When it comes to decorating the place I live in, I am quite happy to let someone else choose the wallpaper. 15. I know if someone shows signs of moving in on my personal space. Answers. First, tot up your scores for questions 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13, and 15. Questions 4, 7, 11, and 14 are different, so leave them for the moment. The total could be 55. If you score between 40 and 55, you are very territorial. If you score between 25 and 40, you are quite territorial. Under 25 makes you very much a free spirit who is not bothered about what is yours. For questions 4, 7, 11, and 14, the answers should go the other way, just to keep readers on their toes. If you said always to question 14, for example, it would mean that you are not very territorial. So a high score of 20 on these four questions would mean you are not territorial at all. A low score would mean that you are very territorial. Try to recall if you have recently had a serious argument with someone because you thought they trespassed into your personal space. What triggered it? The invasion of personal space. As our sense of personal space is both conscious and unconscious, we use many ways of moving to signal whether we want, or don't want, someone to cross the boundary and come inside. Cross into my personal space signs. 1. Little movements of the body which open up the stance. 2. Little turns of the face to really look into someone's eyes. 3. Physically inching closer together. 4. Moving from a closed stance to an open one. It is also wise to recognize signs that mean the opposite. Definite "do not cross into my personal space" signals. 1. Turning the body away. 2. Crossing the arms in front of the body. 3. Retreating movements. 4. The elbow pointing like a shield at someone else. 5. Putting the arms in front of the face. One study found that when we feel our personal space is invaded, we also rub our faces. The question of personal space is intimately linked to that of touch. Touch. We are born able to feel pain and pleasure. As we grow up, this sense develops. One reason we are so sensitive to touch is that the skin is the largest organ of the human body. What do you think it weighs? The answer is that 15% of our body weight is made up of that of the skin. The skin of the average adult covers between 1.5 and 2 square meters. Most of it is between 2 and 3 millimeters thick. The average 2.5 square centimeters holds 650 sweat glands, 20 blood vessels, and more than 1,000 nerve endings or touch receptors. These touch receptors react to pressure, which is what we touch fundamentally is, and fire messages to the brain. Put simply, the pattern of firing tells the brain that a particular touch feels good, bad, or neutral. Most of us have experienced our body hair tingle and even stand on end. This is caused by a rise in something called the galvanic, or electrical, skin response. Scientists have found, when we are emotionally aroused, our skin is, and feels, more electric. They can measure this, showing that fear, anger, being startled, and sexual feelings all produce peaks in the galvanic skin response. In college students, it peaks when a member of the opposite sex comes close to them. No hugs, please. We're British. In 2006, the headmaster of a British school complained that his pupils were too inclined to hug each other. His attitude illustrates neatly the idea that Brits tend to be very different from Latins, who are always touching each other. The anti-hug head announced a ban on touching on school premises, for which he was mocked in the press. Different cultures have different sized personal space bubbles. Though psychologists disagree about how touchy-feely different nations are, many people say Americans are more physical, more likely to hug or slap you on the shoulders than British people. But some American research actually questions this stereotype and claims Americans worry about touch. There is little debate about the Japanese or the Arabs, however. The Japanese hardly ever touch, while Arabs touch all the time, as we shall see in Chapter 11. Exercise 4.3. Self-observation. Write down what kind of touch you like, you dislike, you find erotic, you find frightening. In the next chapter, I look in detail at some aspects of how we use our arms, hands, and feet to reveal and conceal what we are really thinking and feeling. Chapter 5. Body Language's Telling Little Details. Body language can be a matter of life and death. When gladiators fought the lions in ancient Rome, the emperor could decide whether to let them live or let them die. There were no tannoy systems in 50 BC, so how did Caesar let the crowd know? Thumbs up meant, let the gladiator live. Thumbs down meant, the gladiator was to die. We still use thumbs up and down to let people know if things have gone well or badly. But we've adopted the gladiator's perspective. Thumbs down is bad. More recently, and more shockingly, survivors of the Nazi concentration camps, like the writer Primo Levi, have described how they desperately tried hard to walk straight when they were being inspected. If you looked fit, you were less likely to be sent to the gas chambers that day. Body language is not all trivial. A chapter in a book cannot explain every move you make, let alone every breath you take, but it can look at the main components of body language in more detail. So I examine body alignment and angular distance, hands and fingers, arms, feet and toes, puffing up, head and shoulders, lips, self-touch, accessories. Body language and angular distance. The way someone lines up the body towards anyone close to them physically, sometimes called the angular distance, is telling. People align the upper body towards those they like and away from people they dislike or are anxious about. Angular distance may range from 0 degrees, directly facing, to 180 degrees, turning one's back. In the 1960s, body language experts described 8 basic orientations of one person towards another person, all based on how they manipulated the space around them. The most intimate is when people gaze at each other. The most disdainful and hostile is when they turn their backs on the people they are with. Orientation is also a guide to status. You can often work out who is the most powerful person at a conference table by the number of torsos aimed in his or her direction. The lesser chickens in the executive pecking order may look at their colleagues when they speak, but their torsos will be mostly turned to the boss, and even more so if they admire him or her. Nervous people may also swing their bodies away from people. President Richard Nixon, the only American president who has ever had to resign, used to place himself at an exaggerated angle away from visitors to the Oval Office. White House photographs of meetings in the 1970s show Nixon sitting with his shoulders turned away from his advisers at 90 degrees, as if to remove himself from everyone else. Where we place our bodies also affects what we do with our hands. Hands and fingers. We have seen that a huge amount of brain space is dedicated to the hands, and this is because hands help create our intelligence. When babies are born, they can grasp objects, but this is just a reflex. Within a few weeks, they have developed eye-hand coordination and can reach for objects in front of them. By the age of 4 to 5 months, they use this ability to discover what their world is like. A familiar game is for the baby to pick something up, then drop it, and wait for mummy or daddy to pick it up and put the object back in the baby's hands. The great French child psychologist, Jean Piaget, 1896 to 1980, argued that this apparently silly game of reach and drop is the way we start to make sense of the world. As the baby explores with its hands, it begins to develop to what Piaget called sensory motor intelligence, which is the root of all intelligence. By 9 months to a year, babies point at things, the first sign of meaningful communication they master. It's one that stays with people for the rest of their lives. We point at things we want to buy, and less than subtle men point at girls they fancy. An interesting variation of pointing is thumbing your nose, putting your hand to your nose, pointing outwards with your thumb, and wiggling your fingers. I rather like this gesture, which means ho-ho. It again shows what a strange organ the nose is in terms of body language. The last time I did this was after a young woman asked me if the t-shirt I was wearing meant I was going back into grunge. She thought I was too old for that. I responded by thumbing my nose. "That is so childish," Belinda laughed. She was right, but it made the point. Incidentally, neither of us recognized that 18th century Italians used this gesture a great deal. The nose touch, when we lie, also helps to conceal an increase of blood flow to the nose, a kind of nasal blushing. So it is a displacement activity, which stems from our unconscious awareness of how we show traces of lying on the nose. Many subtler hand gestures conceal more delicate kinds of ambivalence. Palms. When a mother puts her hand around a child, it's a sign of love, but also of control and comfort. Anthropologists have seen a Ghanaian tribal elder beat his palm down to convince his listeners that his wives did prefer polygamy. To have the palms up, however, is a gesture of helplessness and resignation. When you see someone do this, you might be tempted to stick the following words in their mouths: "Heaven help me, I'm dealing with someone very silly here." Palms also betray anxiety, because they can sweat and become moist. The first director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, never hired any agents whose handshakes were moist, because he felt they would lack moral as well as manual grip. There were a number of other common palm gestures, and two are linked to prayer. When we pray, we lace our fingers together, and sometimes we form a steeple so that our fingers point straight to heaven. But these aren't just signs of faith. Both these gestures often lead to small movements that betray anxiety. Many of us start to tap our fingers against each other, or to twist our fingers in our laced hands. If you tend to do this, practice relaxing your fingers so they don't fidget. If you struggle to do that, put your hands behind your back, because it will then be much less noticeable. We also sometimes sit on our hands, which means, in effect, we are sitting on your palms. Next time you do this, check whether your palms are up or down. If you are sitting on your upwardly facing palms, This suggests you are trying to hide your feelings of vulnerability. If you are sitting on the back of your hands, that is, with down-facing palms, you are probably angry and want to control the person you are talking to. But think, perhaps unconsciously, that you had better not show how livid you are. By sitting on your palms, you suppress some of your anger. You also often see people lace their fingers one by one and touch them, even caress them a little. Again, it's a sign of anxiety and an attempt to soothe ourselves. Arms. Many people just don't know what to do with their arms, and so end up in what seems a tangle of nerves. The arm cross. People cross their arms defensively all over the world. Women tend to use this gesture when they are with men that they do not like, or with a man who is making them angry. With arms and elbows pulled tightly into the body, the arm cross suggests acute nervousness or chronic anxiety. The arm cross can almost become a self-hug, which, like all self-touch, is an attempt to self-comfort. You would like someone to hug you, to make you feel better, but since no one is there, or no one will do it, you have to hug yourself. But when the arms are pressed less than tightly against the chest, with the elbows held high and away from the body, the arm cross is less a cry for help, and more a wary stance. You are on guard. Usually, we cross our arms in front of our chest, but men sometimes also cross their hands in front of their crotch. One situation where this has been observed is when men are crowded together. Hands on hips. With our hands on our hips, we are ready to take charge and trumpet that we are not going to be messed around with. The police take this posture seriously as a warning sign that someone is proud to be antisocial. We don't know whether this gunslinger pose predates our fascination with the Wild West, or whether it has sneaked its way into our body language through the 1001 Westerns in which the cowboy puts his hands on his hips before drawing his gun. Case history. Two observations by law enforcement officers show how they often worry when they see people adopt the gunslinger pose. An FBI agent, Joe Navarro, said, "It is a territorial claiming gesture usually present when something is wrong. I don't recommend that officers responding to domestic situations stand in doorways with arms akimbo. They are blocking the king's castle, they are being territorial, and it is a hostile statement when diffusion is needed instead. On the other hand, I encourage female officers to use arms akimbo more often to establish greater territory and thus greater authority." Another officer argues he has always felt on guard seeing someone in this pose, and that he recalled one case where he was questioning a suspect who had one hand on his hip. Another policeman told psychologists in Los Angeles about an occasion when he thought he was making headway when talking to a suspect, but the hands-on-hip gesture was actually helping him not confess. "I finally realized what was going on, so I broke this stance by dropping my pen." Shortly after he picked up my conveniently dropped pen, he confessed. If someone faces you, hands on hips, take a look at his feet. Are they planted firmly on the ground or fidgeting? If you are looking at calm, firm feet, duck for cover. Either verbally or physically, the person in front of you is about to launch some attack. Feet and toes. Some philosophers believe moving your feet helps you to use your brain. Followers of Aristotle, 384 to 322 BC, were known as peripatetics because they walked while they pondered their deep thoughts. Every mile meant a new insight. A quarter of all human bones are in the feet, and the position of the feet gives much away, especially indicating whether you do or do not have rapport with the other person. Some experts call this toeing in, as opposed to toeing out. One canny study even found that members of a jury may unconsciously point their feet away from lawyers with whom they disagree. Puffing up. When toads want to impress other toads, they puff themselves up. Humans do much the same. We exaggerate our chest and shoulder size, which is why military uniforms and business suits are often cut so as to swell our profiles. Some species, like cats, dogs, and lions, puff up their hair to intimidate others. King Kong went further in the best gorilla tradition by thumping his chest. We go to a good hairdresser instead to make our hair look good, which gives the impression that we are in control. Exercise 5.1, self-observation. Think of the last time you went to a meeting where you had to impress someone. How did you dress? Did you behave like a toad? Head and shoulders. We nod, shake our heads, tilt them up and down. The meaning of some of these movements is obvious, but things are not always that clear when it comes to head tilting. The head tilt. If we tilt our heads when talking to someone, we are probably unconsciously trying to create rapport, but this is one of those non-verbal behaviors which carries a different meaning when women do it and when men do it. Women who tilt their heads, as Princess Diana often did, tend to appear coy and submissive. There is probably a book to be written on whether Diana tilted her head less as she became less inclined to obey the rules of being a royal. Men tend to tilt their heads back rather than to the side, and this conveys a very different message from the female head tilt. The male head tilt betrays the fact that someone feels superior and not remotely submissive. A number of politicians have used this gesture in public speeches, including Al Gore, the Italian fascist dictator Benito Mussolini, and the American president Franklin D. Roosevelt. For all their political differences, when these men tilted their heads back, they were showing contempt and scorn. Sometimes scornful men also lift one eyebrow higher than the other, narrow their eyes, and raise their lower lip. Hands behind the head, or rubbing the back of the neck. When athletes get angry, according to a 1971 study, they often put their hands behind their heads. I have often seen footballers do this, and the gesture starts when we are children. Children often do it when their parents tell them off. The FBI, which teaches its agents to observe the minutiae of body language, sees this gesture as a useful giveaway in interviews. Joe Navarro, 2003, one of their experts on nonverbal communication, notes, "During interviews, I have observed people touching the back of the neck immediately after being told that they are suspect, and then followed up each time the investigators were accurate in describing something only the suspect knew about. I also noted the speed at which the arm races to the back of the neck and head as being significant, and the amount of force applied once the hand reached the head or back of the neck." Navarro also believes it is useful to look for the angle of the head and neck as the hand strokes the back of the head or neck. The greater the angle away from the vertical, the more troublesome the issue for the person. I saw a man literally bend forward to the point where he lifted himself off the chair as he brought his hand to the back of the neck and then bent forward as he was being confronted. The hand, or hands behind the head, reveal uncertainty, conflict, frustration, anger, or dislike. To try to hide such feelings, people sometimes start to massage their necks for comfort. Desmond Morris argued that when the hand swings up abruptly and clamps itself hard onto the nape of the neck, it is a sign of suddenly aroused but otherwise unexpressed anger. Shrugging the shoulders. We shrug our shoulders to suggest we're not too sure of what we're saying. This is a nonverbal cue that can modify and contradict the meaning of our spoken words. On July 11, 1996, while orbiting in the Russian space station Mir, US astronaut Shannon Lucid shrugged her shoulders, tilted her head, and gestured with her palm up as she answered some questions about her six-week delay in returning to Earth. "You know," she told NBC's Today Show, "that's life." Like our shoulders, our lips can convey many messages. Lips. The incensed gorilla clenches its lips, In the highlands of Papua New Guinea, when men were asked to show what they would do when angry and about to attack, psychologist Paul Ekman found they pressed their lips together. The executive often does the same in the corporate jungle. When your boss is furious, she is apt to clench her lips, a small droop at the corner of the mouth, through the unconscious contraction of a muscle called the depressor anguli oris, is often the first sign of grief or disappointment. The compression of the lips is known as the tense mouth look. As a rule, the more open the mouth, the more relaxed you are. A yawn is the prime example, because it shows very openly how bored you are. The stifled yawn, where you keep your mouth closed while forcing air in through your clenched lips, is a different matter. Sticking the tongue out is a big gesture of disdain, but very often people just dart their tongues a few millimeters out of their mouths. This tongue show suggests dislike or disagreement with something that has just been said. Take it as a warning sign. That holds good for gorillas too. A gorilla pushed from its favorite branch will let its tongue protrude in displeasure. The tongue show can be discreet. On my favorite observation ground, the tube, I watched a couple in their 30s. She clenched her lips, chewed them, and her tongue protruded in a small tongue show. But her partner did not notice any of these movements. He was sitting, turned slightly away from her, looking at his shopping in the carrier bag at his feet. Suddenly, something funny occurred to him, and he did the quite unexpected, bumping her with his shoulders and then turning to her. As he caught sight of her tense face, he realized something was wrong, but he didn't say anything. He just bumped her again, playfully. She suddenly smiled, and they became like little kids on dodgems, bumping their shoulders against each other. It transformed her mood. A few seconds later, her head was on his shoulder. The anxieties that had made her show her tongue had quite disappeared. Licking the lips is an attempt to comfort ourselves, one of many self-touch movements. Self-touch. In our stressed society, we often hug, caress, touch our wrists with our hands, pick at ourselves, and scratch. Women often fiddle with their arms and inspect their hair for split ends. It would be interesting to know whether there are more self-touches now than in the past. Again, we inherited this way of diffusing stress from our ape ancestors. The great student of apes, Jane Van Lawlick Goodall, noted, "The more intense the anxiety or conflict situation, the more vigorous the scratching becomes. It typically occurred when the chimpanzees were worried or frightened by my presence or that of a high-ranking chimpanzee. Motherless rhesus monkeys touch themselves very intensely. They suck their thumbs or toes, clasp themselves, and engage in head-banging. Like psychiatric patients, who often regress in similar ways, the orphaned monkeys feel abandoned and are desperately trying to comfort themselves. Children under stress, like children in Romanian orphanages, often do that. These children also often rock themselves for comfort, a movement that Orthodox Jews adopt when they pray. The more they rock, the more fervent their prayers. I find it comforting that our most powerful politicians can act just like monkeys. It will be remembered Tony Blair stroked his stomach while Gordon Brown was speaking at a Labour Party conference. Usually, if you're trying to establish credibility and cool, it looks a lot better if you don't touch yourself. All these details are instructive, because you don't have to be a slave to your body language habits. So, in exercise 5.2, I offer a suggestion to help you change those habits. Partly this is for fun, but partly it is because we all tend to get stuck in a rut. Remove yourself from your rut by following the ideas below. Exercise 5.2. Self-observation. Write down your most familiar gestures. When are you happy and when are you annoyed? Think of alternatives, even if they seem ridiculous. For example, next time you are annoyed, instead of tapping your fingers on the coffee table, stand on the coffee table and yawn. The point of this exercise is to remind you that you don't have to be a slave to the habits of your body language. Accessories and status symbols. Mobiles. Compare the mobile phone with the worry beads used in some cultures, for example, in Greece. Men fidget with their worry beads to reduce anxiety and perhaps even to get into a meditative mood. Women fidget with their hair and their jewelry. Few of us in the West have worry beads, but technology has provided us with an accessory that is even better for expressing anxiety, the mobile phone. The avid interpreter of body language could do worse than look at the poses people adopt in relationship to their mobiles. This has become an interesting area of research, as mobile phone companies are very rich and desperate to know everything about how people use their mobiles. Mobiles allow us to express our anxieties. People often caress their mobiles with their fingers as if they're rubbing Aladdin's lamp. If you can intone the right spell, maybe your messages will be magic for you. Some killjoys, well, killjoys if you are wedded to your mobile phone, fret that now everyone in the West has a mobile phone glued to their ear, body language may change drastically. As we become ever more absorbed in calling and texting rather than speaking face to face, will we forget to nod and smile at the right moment? The findings are reassuring. Some of us still use body language while we are on the phone, even if nobody is looking at us. A study showed that about 20% of people who talk on mobiles still gesture, smile, and nod as though someone else were there to listen and watch. The research has also established that people tend to adopt two different poses when speaking. One has been called the speakeasy pose. Speakeasies often assume an open stance and are happy to be on the phone and let other people see what they are doing. The mobile phone becomes part of their personal display, like an expensive hairdo. They exude confidence, even brio. By contrast, some people adopt a more withdrawn spacemaker pose. Spacemakers, who may have profound psychological issues, create a personal space in which to speak on the mobile. They almost hide the mobile, arms are huddled around the body. When they are sitting, spacemakers sometimes lift their feet off the ground. These are all signs that they close the world out to focus exclusively on their call. The interesting psychological question is whether there are different poses to go with different kinds of personality. I am sure some enterprising social scientist has already offered to investigate, as long as Orange or TalkTalk send a suitably large check. Speakeasies seem to outnumber spacemakers, though that is only my impression. It certainly seems true that we have fewer and fewer inhibitions about talking animatedly into our mobile phones, so everyone can see whether we are happy or sad. Maybe mobile phones are making the once-uptight British less inhibited. Cars and the gym. Cars are a major status symbol in our society. In most couples, the person who drives most of the time will be the dominant one, or the one you can't bear not to be in charge. However, if the driver taps the wheel all the time, this suggests that he or she does not feel entirely relaxed. The gym has become a place where we don't just train, but where we show off. The major narcissist will always be checking on himself or herself in the mirror. Supermarket watch. If you want to become an expert on body language, walk around your local supermarket and watch for the following interactions between couples. Who controls the trolley? When a couple decide to buy something, do they check with each other? When a couple get to the checkout and they realize they have forgotten something, who goes to get it? You can deduce a great deal from this. The one who stays at the checkout is almost certainly the dominant partner in that relationship in public, because he or she has effectively sent the other one out to fetch and carry. This does not necessarily mean that they will be the dominant one in intimate situations, but it is very possible. Finally, a slightly cynical version of some aspects of body language. What does it mean when a man holds a woman's face
while kissing. Please believe me, I'm very serious about kissing you. So shall we tumble into bed? What message do you send to a man when you tug at your rings? I'll leave my husband if you leave your wife, but before that, Charlie, you're not getting any more than a peck on the cheek. What does it mean when a man puts his thumbs in his trousers and pockets while talking to a woman? Have I got news for you? Or at least, that's what he wants you to believe.